You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 25th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Glenn Greenwald from The Guardian magazine, newspaper, I should say, on the past, I guess now, month of NSA revelations from the leaker Edward Snowden. Also on the program today, President Obama heading back into populist mode. Will it make a difference? We shall see. Bank forecloses, steals essentially a woman's belongings, and not so quick to give it back. Meanwhile, those people expecting checks from that financial fraud settlement have been waiting and waiting. And now there's a push to ease the restrictions on banks or originators maintaining skin in the game in providing mortgages. Also in Pennsylvania, it appears that same-sex marriage is getting a de facto legalization there. And we will also talk about the minimum wage and get to that story about Mickey D's basically expecting or trying to helpfully suggest to its minimum wage workers how they can get by and budget. But before we go to the Glenn Greenwald interview yesterday, in the House, the Hamish-Conyers Amendment, which would bar bulk collection of Americans' business records and presumably all of their phone records, an amendment which would have been attached to the Pentagon spending bill, failed. However, it failed only by 12 votes. In what turned out to be a bipartisan insurrection of sorts, where rank-and-file members voted against their respective leadership in the House and against the wishes of the White House. The amendment was opposed by John Boehner and Minority Leader Pelosi. The leadership of the House did not whip against it, apparently. The final tally, most Republicans, 134, voted against the Amash Amendment. 94 voted for it. Most Democrats voted for the Amash Conyers' co-sponsored amendment on an 111 to 83 vote. Again, it failed by 12 votes, 217 to 205. This is just the beginning of attempts to reform what the NSA is doing, what the FISA court is doing. Rush Holt introduced legislation to that effect yesterday. We know that Wyden will be offering bills in the Senate. We will talk more about that in the coming days. People who are interested in civil liberties are taking this as a good sign that the ball is moving forward. It is certainly the most controversial, and by that I mean the closest vote on the Patriot Act and its authorization that we've had since it was passed in 2001. And Sensenbrenner, who is the sort of self-ID'd author of the Patriot Act, also voted in favor of this amendment. So with that in mind, we're going to take a break. We're going to go to this interview with Glenn Greenwald, which we did on Tuesday of this week. And we'll be back in just a moment. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Glenn Greenwald. He is a writer for The Guardian and author of several best-selling New York Times best-selling books. Glenn, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Now, Glenn, what is this? I want to start with, what is this I hear about your co-op?
Yes, well, it is a huge scandal, and I'm a little bit embarrassed by it and irritated that you brought it up because it's so shameful.
Yes, I understand. Well, co-ops, we'll do a special internet-only version of the interview about the co-op. But, well, it's been a while since we spoke, of course. The last we spoke was about 2 weeks before the beginning of these massive revelations that you presented were presented from Edward Snowden, obviously via you, and somewhat the Washington Post. And at that time, you had hinted that you were working on some stories that you felt probably had attracted the attention of the authorities in some way. I imagine there's been a lot more of that, and I want to talk about those parts of it. But now that we are several weeks out from those revelations, give me your sense of what the biggest things that we learned from the Edward Snowden leaks.
Well, keep in mind that, and I know I've been saying this repeatedly, usually when I'm asked, but also when someone says something that requires me to point it out, which is that we really still are near the beginning of these revelations. The number of documents that he gave was in the many thousands. And has taken a lot of time for me to go through and sort and process and understand and report. And there's still lots of stories coming. I'm not trying to tease the stories. It's just a fact. So when I say that here's what we've learned so far, the operative words are so far, essentially the bottom line is that the NSA is building a system that has its objective. Full-scale and complete surveillance, by which I mean that every form of human communication that takes place electronically, either on the internet or through telephones or related technology, is within the surveillance of the NSA, and that they actually collect it all, store it, analyze it, and then can access it at any time, which is really the erosion of privacy around the world, not just in the United States. And the specific revelations include things like the NSA is collecting all telephone records of all Americans using both their local and international calls under a very warped interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, a ruling that was issued by the secret FISA court in total secrecy. The NSA has all kinds of arrangements and collusion and cooperation and collaboration with Silicon Valley, the largest internet companies in the world, to assure themselves of all sorts of unfettered access to the chats, the emails, the messages, the videos that are transmitted through these companies. We know that President Obama has authorized global internet, offensive internet attacks, which is basically the militarization of the internet, both domestically and internationally. We know that the top-level national security official in the Obama administration, James Clapper, lied to the faces of Congress when asked whether or not the NSA was collecting millions of records on Americans, and he said no, denying that they're doing exactly that which we revealed that they are doing, and lots of other stories as well that all prove the same point, that there's this ubiquitous spying apparatus being constructed secretly with virtually no oversight.
And conceptually speaking, I mean, what we're talking about is essentially collecting all this data and creating almost a lending library, right? I mean, of the history of the communications going back. I mean, at this point, it appears 5 years, but maybe it's even more. And it's a lending library of sorts that. It seems different agencies in the U.S. government can in some way or another access if they're engaged in some type of investigation.
Well, first of all, one of the things that makes it so disturbing and one of the reasons it has resonated as much as it has is the issue is that it's indiscriminate, that it's not targeted at just people who are involved in a particular investigation or even what the Patriot Act was designed to do, which is allow them to get records quote-unquote, relevant to an investigation. The reason why the Patriot Act is so controversial is because it dramatically lowered the standard that they needed to meet to relevance to an investigation. Nobody, even the people warning most vocally about the Patriot Act when it was enacted, thought that it could be used to gather the information about all Americans, which is what they're doing. And what makes that so pernicious is that not only that they can go in and invade your communications at any time they want, which is what they can do, but by collecting the so-called metadata, the records of who you call, who calls you, how long you speak, who those people then call, or who you email, who emails you, where you are when you send the email, they can create an incredibly invasive picture of who you are, what you do, what your associations are, that in a lot of ways is even more revealing than the contents of your communication itself. And it's an incredibly invasive weapon to give to a state to be able to know that much about all of its citizens and to be able to use it however they want with very little checks or limitations.
And what do you say to someone who says, well, I've got nothing to hide. I don't care if people see that I'm calling my grandma and calling my my friend and calling to order a pizza.
Right. Well, the lives of most adults contain a lot more than calling their grandmothers and calling to order a pizza, which is the reason why adults, even the people who say that, actually value privacy and prove that they do with their actions, even if their words try to deny it. So these are people who will put locks on their bedroom door and their bathroom door because they want to keep people out so they can have places that are private. There are people who put email passwords on their email accounts or their social media accounts so that they have places where they can go and do things and read things and say things and speak to people without other people knowing about it. It's really the very rare individual, the very rarely boring, soulless individual who, quote unquote, has nothing to hide. Most people do things that they don't want other people knowing about because it'll bring them shame or because they will feel judged by it or it'll harm their interest in some way or their relationships in some way. People seek out and crave privacy in all sorts of ways. It's really a human need. And a society in which there's no privacy, where you feel as though you're constantly being watched, is one that really breeds conformity because it's only in those instances where you can act without judgmental eyes being cast upon you do people feel free to explore limits or to engage in dissent or to challenge orthodoxy. And it's why every tyrannical government has as one of its first priorities creating a massive surveillance system and destroying privacy, because a citizenry that is constantly watched is a citizenry that will be kept in line. It really radically alters our life collectively and our lives as individuals when we have no sphere where we can do things without people knowing about it.
And speaking as one of those boring people, one of my concerns is, however, is that we have both a fluid. I mean, even as the program is constituted now, it seems to not just apply to quote unquote terrorists. And we also have the issue of the fluidity of that term. I mean, I don't think 25 years ago anybody was referring to people who would chain themselves to a tree to stop a pipeline as a terrorist. But we see more and more, as that's added to the lexicon, this notion of eco-terrorists. You know, we have seen in the past that vegans have been surveilled when they protest. And part of the concern, it seems to me, is also what our society is. There seems to be both an ever-growing compulsion to know more about our society in terms of invading privacy, but also an equally driven compulsion to define that which society or the national security state doesn't like as being outside of sort of any type of legal framework.
Right. I mean, I think there's several points there that are important in what you said. First of all, we don't need to speculate about what likely will happen if we allow a massive surveillance state to be built in the dark. We don't need to speculate about how it will be abused or whether it will be. We already know the answer to that because in the mid-1970s, the Church Committee did a massive, thorough investigation and found out that the United States government, under both Democratic and Republican presidents, continuously for five decades, ever since the surveillance system had been constructed in a potent way in the United States, had been abusing those powers for all sorts of nefarious ends because they were able to exercise it without anyone really looking over their shoulder and finding out what it was they were doing. So there were lots of people in the 1960s who may not have had anything to hide as they saw it themselves, or who may not have been enough of a threat to you, the U.S. government, to make them the subject of abusive surveillance. But the fact that, for example, J. Edgar Hoover was monitoring the communications of Martin Luther King and had thought he found evidence of King's adulterous affairs and had a letter sent to him anonymously saying, we're going to expose this unless you commit suicide, is something that harms the entire society and harms all of us. Or the fact that the government was engaging in all kinds of lawless surveillance against anti-war groups, other left-wing activist groups, and have continued to do so throughout the decades. We then become a society in which any kind of real dissent or challenging of political power becomes very difficult, if not impossible, in a way that really does harm the interests of everybody. And then on top of that, as you say, for the government at this point to say, well, we only use this against terrorists, leaving aside the fact that it's completely untrue, the term terrorist has become so broad. It basically means anybody who meaningfully opposes the U.S. government. WikiLeaks got called terrorists by people like Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden, who called them high-tech terrorists. It's basically a term that means anyone who the government doesn't like and feel threatened by. So that shouldn't give people very much comfort anyway, that the claim that we're only using it against terrorists, even if it were true, which it isn't.
And in fact, you know, one of the revelations has been of our extensive use of spying on people and or nations that are presumably our allies. Where do you think those revelations fit within the broader context of what we know up to this point from Snowden's leaks?
You know, I've paid a lot of attention to how this debate has resonated globally outside of the borders of the United States. I've also participated in reporting on some of it. I've written articles for a large Brazilian newspaper. Laura Poitras, with whom I worked, has written similar articles for Der Spiegel in Germany about U.S. spying on European allies, just like I've written articles about NSA spying indiscriminately on the population of Brazil and the larger population of Latin America. And I think one of the things that is really vital to understand about these disclosures, and one of the reasons that Snowden stepped forward the way he did, was because the U.S. government spends a huge amount of time, effort, energy, and money trying to convince the world that it is a certain thing, that it does certain things in the world. And what I think the impact of these disclosures are internationally, as much as making people understand what's being done to the privacy, is that it's making people open their eyes about what the United States government really is and what its role in the world is. And I think that, you know, people understand and expect the United States to be spying on countries with whom it has serious tension, like Iran, or that it sees as rivals like Russia or China. But the fact that the United States is spying on supposedly its closest allies or countries with whom it has completely amicable relations, like EU states or like Brazil or other countries in Latin America, demonstrates that this isn't about trying to target threats or bad people. It's not about trying to protect the security of the United States. It's only about one thing, and that is knowing what everyone in the world is saying so that the United States continuously can maximize its power. And it radically alters the balance of power between the United States and the rest of the world, between the American population and its government. And that's really why these disclosures are so vital, and how people are taking them on and understanding them is that it's really about the U.S. government continuously entrenching itself as this sort of unchallengeable, ubiquitous empire. And I think it's important for people to know.
What do you think that drives this? I mean, obviously, I mean, the U.S. government is not a monolith it's made up of individuals. There is certain, like, you know, in any type of policies or practices that are implemented, there are different forces that sort of drive it forward. I think, you know, one of the more interesting meta aspects of Snowden coming forward is just how much private contractors now drive and function both to execute this policy, and I would imagine also to expand it. Just give me your sense of what drives this. I mean, is it as simple as to simply say the U.S. government wants power, or what is going on in the individuals who execute these policies?
Well, as your question astutely suggests, it's always very difficult to answer a question about what motivates a huge, diffuse system like the United States to take action. It's like trying to figure out what motivated the attack on Iraq. It's almost impossible to answer that question because there's so many different motives that are found among so many different factions that compose the United States government and the forces that control it. So you can never really answer it in a clean, clear way that really is persuasive. I think the same is true here, though there are a couple of significant factors that ensure its continuation. One is institutional inertia, by which I mean that if you build this massive spying agency like the NSA and you impose no real limits on it, and you continuously pour huge amounts of money onto it and basically give them a mandate to learn more and more, there's nothing institutionally that will ever cause it to stop. The inertia of the institution will constantly say, let's wake up tomorrow and figure out new ways to collect even more. Let's figure out what we're not getting and find out how we can get it. It's not necessarily even a philosophical or ideological or political thought process. The dynamic is really just, it's the institutional mandate to collect as much as you can. And once you have that as your mission, you don't see yourself as nefarious. You don't see any reason to stop. So you don't stop. You just keep expanding it until somebody stops it for you. And I think that's a big part of what has been happening. The other part is what you also suggested in your question, which is it is a huge money-making endeavor, the surveillance state. In the wake of 9/11, massive tidal waves of money just poured forth onto the national security state and the surveillance apparatus, which it controls. And most of this is privatized. So most of the functions of the surveillance state are privatized or outsourced to private corporations. I think it's something like 25,000 people work directly for the NSA, but 60,000 people are like Snowden. They work at the NSA effectively, but are technically employed by private corporations who have contracts with the NSA. So you have this huge faction inside Washington, which is the private surveillance industry and the private national security industry, that has a major incentive to make sure that these policies continue without limits. They have lots of power in Washington, and there's very little countervailing force that wants to and is able to ever put a stop to it, because there's just not enough of an organized lobby advocating for privacy or against surveillance limits. And that was one of the imbalances that Snowden perceived, which is that he could go to members of the Senate or Congress, but they're so constrained with what they could do that the money behind and the power behind the surveillance state is such that it's completely uneven playing field. And the only way to try and begin to equalize that playing field is to inform his fellow citizens exactly what is going on in this world.
And in some respects, I mean, that equalizing the playing field, or to the extent that one can actually do that in this context, I mean, it has happened insofar as it seems that, you know, and we are doing this interview on Tuesday, on a day where you have Republican Justin Amash and John Conyers proposing a bill which would end the authority under the Patriot Act, Section 215, of the mass surveillance, and tying this to the Pentagon budget, one which I guess has caused General Alexander to request a private meeting with some of the Senate and House leadership. You also have Ron Wyden at the Center for American Progress going on and suggesting that we need to repeal these things, talking about this regime of secret law. The ability of codifying, making public that which we have heard whispers about or seen people talk around, now has at least created almost entered this into a more democratic process in that, you know, now people have standing in court theoretically to take this on. This seems to me to be an incredibly important aspect of this.
The beneficial aspects of these disclosures exceed what I thought was possible in my wildest dreams when I began to work on this. And people often ask me how, you know, are you in regular contact with Snowden? How is he doing? And what I always say, which is completely true, is that he couldn't be happier or more content with the choice that he made. I remember the first time that I ever spoke with him, he told me that he wanted to out himself as the source, that he knew that he was risking very likely that he would go to prison for the rest of his life. He said he doesn't fear that at all. He believes in the rightness of what he was doing. The only fear that he had was that he would essentially throw his entire life away to make these disclosures, and that the public would just sort of look at everything and kind of shrug their shoulders and react with indifference and apathy and say, we figured most of this is already going on, and besides, we don't really much care, and that nothing would really change. And so for him to watch not only this real serious movement for reforming the NSA that is more bipartisan in nature than anything I've ever seen in the time I've been writing about politics, and then to see this debate replicated globally in countless countries around the world is incredibly gratifying to him, because that's what he wanted to achieve. And it's incredibly gratifying to me, because when you go and sort of take the risks and do the amount of work that was necessary to do the reporting on this story, that's what you hope to achieve. And yet, yeah, I think, you know, nobody was so optimistic that we thought within 6 weeks there would be major bills with lots of bipartisan support in Congress and in the Senate, and real controversy over the lies that Obama officials told to the Congress. There'd be serious shifts in public opinion about the balance between privacy and civil liberties and security all within 6 weeks. It's really been extraordinary. And I think what it shows is that the reason people haven't cared about these issues before isn't because they don't care about them. It's because they simply didn't know that all of this was happening. And being able to show them in the form not of warnings or text articles, but to show them the actual documents that they can see and read for themselves, and that process has been incredibly powerful.
I mean, it's fascinating, because it almost feels like there was a sort of pent-up demand within the House and the Senate to do something about this. Because, frankly, from my perspective, we see all the time, 85% support of Social Security, yet even the president is proposing cutting Social Security. It, for the most part, it doesn't feel like public opinion compels our lawmakers to do much of anything. Yet in this instance where, I know that the polls have showed a change in perspective by the general population, but it doesn't seem like we're not seeing massive protests on the streets. We're not seeing an activity in Congress, like you say, on both sides of the aisle, that is unprecedented, in, at least in these in this day and age. I don't know of anything else that has garnered that. Maybe, you know, maybe back in the height of the financial crisis, you know, some notion of auditing the Fed, but this seems to be broader than that. And I mean, do you think there is something in particular that is particularly offensive to lawmakers in this, in that they were left in the dark about this authority? I mean, because for me, one of the most important revelations is this notion that the FISA court has the ability to create law by adjudicating on it, but there's no recourse for that law to be challenged, and it's not an adversarial situation. I mean, this is basically like a court that issues bench warrants, you know, functioning as the Supreme Court.
You know, it's a hard question to answer because, you know, to be completely honest, it actually took me a little bit by surprise. I mean, I knew that these stories are going to be big stories journalistically. Like, I knew that, you know, if you get 10,000 top secret documents from the most secretive agency in the U.S. government that has never leaked even a snippet of a memo before, and you suddenly have in your possession thousands of those documents and you're about to start publishing them to the world, of course they're going to be significant. I knew they were going to, you know, attract attention, but I didn't think that it was going to generate the kind of sustained outrage in the elite opinion-making class and such shifts in perception on many different levels as it has. And I've tried thinking about the reasons why, and I don't really have definitive answers, because one of the things that you said, which I think is true, is that a lot of lawmakers find this offensive because it somehow tramples on their institutional authority. They were lied to. These things were concealed from them. Even the authors of the Patriot Act feel like they were betrayed because now the NSA went way beyond what they all thought they were authorizing. I also think that it's just offensive on an intuitive level, like the idea that the U.S. government is collecting everybody's local and international phone records and keeping them and analyzing them and doing the same to their emails and doing all these shady, unclear agreements with Silicon Valley. I think it just feels like the kind of thing that's not supposed to be happening in the United States. And if you're somebody on the left who believes in individual civil liberties, or somebody on the right who believes in the right of the individual to be left alone by a limited federal government, I think it's offensive. But I don't think that gets really as far as we might want it to go in terms of explanation, because I remember in 2005 when the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration was spying on American citizens without the warrants required by law, that had all the same aspects to it. I mean, there, not only did Congress not know about it, although a few members did, like Nancy Pelosi and Jay Rockefeller and a couple other ones, but in general, the vast majority of members of Congress didn't know. That was a case where the Bush administration was actually breaking the law that Congress had passed. It was Congress's law in 1978 that said that you can't spy on Americans without first getting warrants, and that was the law the Bush administration secretly violated. And that, too, was massive spying in the dark, and yet there was very little of this kind of scandal. And maybe it was because we were still too close to 9/11. The climate of the country was still very subservient to what the Bush administration wanted to do. Maybe it's because there weren't documents disclosed as part of that. It was just a one-time story. But I think there's something in the ethos here that, to be honest, I just haven't quite put my finger on about why this has resonated in such a profound and clearly enduring way. And I guess it's something worth thinking about more.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because I would say those revelations about there was more there seemed to be more talk about it outside of the sort of elite class than in. And on some level, the reaction here has been that there's more response where the lawmakers are sort of almost in some respects getting out ahead of at least some of the popular movements, and I suspect the distance from 9/11 and its power as a political tool, I mean electoral tool, it has been diminished by time. I don't want to spend too much time talking about Snowden per se, because I feel like there's, to a certain extent, we know as much in many respects as we're going to know about him, perhaps. I don't know. But one of the things that I have wondered about in terms of sort of the meta of this story is from the very beginning is where you, I mean, how, and by this point, there's obviously been a lot more sort of understanding of who Edward Snowden is or and was up to the moment that he leaked. But what was it like for you? I mean, how were you able or were you able to have a notion of who this guy was and whether or not the documents you were getting were legit? I would imagine you also were concerned about revealing who he was before he had done that himself.
Right. So, first of all, I think there's this misconception that I've been somehow arguing that questions or discussions about Snowden are totally trivial and irrelevant. I don't actually think that at all. The criticism I've made of the media isn't that they've done reporting on Snowden or wanted to know about Snowden. It was that that's come at the expense of the substantive revelations, that they're so obsessed with the personality parts of it that they've essentially written out of their narrative what has actually been revealed about the NSA. And they're so focused on declaring him a criminal and all the bad things that he's done in their eyes while ignoring the much more serious criminality by people who have a lot more power, namely those who are running the NSA and who are at the highest levels of the Obama administration. So that's been my critique. I actually think it is important to understand Snowden. He's a historical figure at this point. He's probably the most significant whistleblower of the last century. And Daniel Ellsberg, who is probably the competitor for that title, himself says that that's the case. I think it's really fascinating to understand why somebody at the age of 29 would throw away what most people would view as a really, not just satisfactory, but lucky and blessed life, in order to pursue abstract political goals that really don't benefit that person in any way. I think and I hope that his actions will inspire other people to be sufficiently brave to come forward. Remember, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, two U.S. senators, have been running around the country for 2 years warning the American public that the Obama administration had these secret interpretations of law that were really radical and warped, and that they had used these interpretations of law to vest themselves with radical power that, in their words, would stun the American people if they learned about it. And yet Senators Wyden and Udall, even though they're two of the better senators on this stuff, lack the courage that Edward Snowden has, which is they lack the courage to come forward and tell Americans what it was that they were talking about, what was so alarming. So it took Edward Snowden, a 29-year-old kid who doesn't have the protections that those senators have, to come and tell us. And figuring out and understanding why and thinking about why that's heroic and noble and we owe him our gratitude, I think, are really important. To answer your question specifically, when I went to Hong Kong, I had already spent a lot of hours talking to him before I got there, mostly online, in fact, exclusively online. And, obviously my first goal when I began talking to him, and then certainly once I got to Hong Kong, where I spent, I don't know how many hours, but I was there 12 days. I was, speaking to him either in person or online, probably 10 hours a day, at least during the time I was in Hong Kong, probably more. So I spent a lot of time with him. And one of my first goals was to understand why he chose to do what he did, both because I had a real curiosity to understand why somebody would do that, but also I needed to assure myself that if somebody was going to take a step which would unravel their lives and bring upon them very serious consequences, I needed to know that they had really thought it through, that they were open-eyed and rational about it. And I spent a long time questioning him about that in lots of different ways. And what I continuously heard was the same thing, which was very persuasive to me, which was, I'm somebody who judges the worth of my life based not on my beliefs, but based on the actions that I take in pursuit of those beliefs. I grew up in the world of the internet, where the promise of the internet was that you could explore things without anyone knowing, that you could enjoy anonymity and privacy. And I don't want to live in a world where that's destroyed, where the internet becomes this tool of oppression rather than the tool of liberation. And that I just can, in good conscience, be part of this secret, nefarious, destructive system that is being built by the United States against my fellow citizens of the rest of the world, and sit by quietly and have people ignorant of it. I just wouldn't be able to live with myself. And so it became very clear to me, and it was very persuasive why he did what he did, that he was genuine and authentic about the things that he was saying. I vetted these documents, you know, for a long time. There were thousands of them. It would have been impossible for someone to just fraudulently manufacture them.
Right.
I saw his ID. I saw his government documents. You know, I saw a lot of things that made me believe in the authenticity of who he was and what he was saying. Obviously, you know, you can never get proof with mathematical certainty. And I knew that had this been fake, my credibility, the credibility of The Guardian would be forever crippled. So you do what you can to assure yourself that it's all real, but ultimately you have to rely on your own judgment and intuition about who is genuine and authentic and who isn't. And by the end of the second day in Hong Kong, I had zero doubt, literally zero doubt, that he was exactly who he said he was, that he had done what he did for exactly the reasons that he claimed, and that the documents were completely real, and all of that turned out to be true.
I mean, and how did you, I mean, how did you, I mean, I guess, you know, to a certain extent, you've got all of these thousands of documents. Maybe this question answers itself. But on some level, you know, how did you know that it wasn't necessarily, I mean, I guess maybe you've answered this, but one thing that just struck me was you don't have the ability to call Booz Allen and say, hey, incidentally, do you have, you know, the day before you're looking at these documents, can I ask you about an employee who hasn't come in for a couple of days? I mean, did you have at any time any concern that maybe you were seeing something that was interagency? Here's a guy by his own accounting had worked for the CIA and then sort of had moved over to the NSA. Was there ever a time where you contemplated maybe this is something that's also internally happening?
Sure. I mean, there was a 2008 document that was written by the U.S. Army, and it was designated top secret. And it was about WikiLeaks, and it declared WikiLeaks to be an enemy of the state and talked about ways that the U.S. Army could destroy WikiLeaks or cripple their ability to function. And one of the things it talked about was that if fraudulent documents were leaked to WikiLeaks, which then published it, that would forever destroy their credibility. Nobody would ever believe anything they had to say ever again. And so the possibility that this is all a trick or a plot or it's entrapment or just somebody playing some kind of like elaborate joke or something more kind of odious, of course, those possibilities are things that you think about. You would be reckless not to. But, you know, you do everything you can to eliminate that possibility by vetting what it is that you're seeing, by, you know, I spent probably 24 hours in the first couple of days just relentlessly interrogating him to search for inconsistencies or uncertainties or things that just didn't quite feel or ring correct. You know, but my prior life, I was a lawyer. I took depositions where I would do that for days at a time with witnesses and feel like I know how to kick the tires really hard on somebody's story. But especially in this world of intelligence and surveillance and the CIA, all kinds of things are done that aren't what they seem. They specialize in lying to people and deceiving people and tricking people. They're very good at it. And so, of course, you have to be very guarded and careful about what it is that you're choosing to believe, because it is your reputation and your career ultimately on the line, your ability to achieve things in a meaningful way. But given all of that, all the questioning I did of him, I, you know, have been working on surveillance a long time in the NSA for a long time, so the documents rang true to me. I was able to link them to other things that I knew about. I worked with some people who had expertise in these things and was able to talk to them. But ultimately, I relied mostly on my intuition, the intuition of Laura Poitras, with whom I was working, and got into a position where I felt very comfortable publishing this on the basis that it was true.
And lastly, in terms of Snowden, I mean, I you know, you said that when you first met him, he said he doesn't fear any jail time, and which is, you know, in certainly something that I know that I would have significantly feared. But he is, it sounds now as if he has basically accepted at least some type of quasi-permanent status in Russia, as far as what I can see in news reports today. Do you think that did his perspective change on that, or was that he was aware of the possibility he would go to jail? That was not enough for him to do this, but he has the sort of, I guess, the typical human desire to not be in jail.
Yes, for most, well, I would say for all sane people by definition, the prospect of being put into a tiny cage and having your life completely constrained and controlled until you die is a generally unpleasant idea that you would like to avoid if you can. So when I say that he was not fearful of jail, that isn't the same thing as saying he desired prison.
Right.
He would like to remain out of prison. He realized, though, when he did what he did, that there was a very good chance that he would be able to, he would not be able to have that desire fulfilled, that he would actually end up in American custody. It's still a possibility that he will. And he made his choice knowing that that was a possibility. One of the things that is important to him is to be able to continue to participate in the debate that he helped to provoke. If he thought that he could get a fair trial in the United States, he would not have left the United States. He would go back to the United States now. But he's seen what happened to Bradley Manning, who was taken and put into a cage, not allowed out of prison while the charges were pending for 2.5 years, was kept completely incommunicado so that we never heard Bradley Manning's voice until the organization that I helped found, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, published against the orders of the court an audio recording of Manning in his court-martial proceeding 2.5 years later explaining why he did what he did. So had we not done that, Manning's voice still would not be heard, even though there was all kinds of things that have been said about him. So he doesn't trust the U.S. judiciary for very good reasons. They've proven themselves this corrupt and subservient institution whenever national security claims are made by the U.S. government. Whistleblowers in particular are persecuted. People who are put into prison aren't allowed to participate in the debates. And even Daniel Ellsberg in his Washington Post op-ed said that he thinks Snowden was absolutely right to flee, even though Ellsberg didn't, because it's a much different country now.
Well, Ellsberg was out on bail. Ellsberg was out on bail.
Right. Yeah, he was allowed out on bail. He gave press conferences all the time. He participated in the debate over what he had done. There's zero chance that Snowden would be able to do that. If he came back to the U.S. tomorrow, he would be snatched up, put into a cage, and we'd probably never hear from him again, literally. And so those are not conditions that he's willing to accept. He doesn't trust the legitimacy and validity of the U.S. judicial system where it's political culture, and I don't blame him at all. I wouldn't either if I were him. And so he wants to stay out of prison. He wants to participate in the debate that he helped start. And there aren't many countries in the world that have the both ability and willingness to avoid U.S. dictates, to not capitulate to U.S. dictates, and to enforce his legally recognized right to seek asylum. And Russia happens to be one of those countries, and that's why he's there.
Glenn Greenwald, thanks so much for taking the time. I know that you're very busy these days, and good luck with the rest of the reporting on this story. It sounds like there's going to be a lot more revelations to come. And I appreciate both your appearing and, of course, the work you're doing.
Thanks very much, Sam. Really appreciate it. Always good to talk to you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920. If you want to call, you can IM us at Majority FM or any of our legacy IMs. Again, this program is funded and is maintained almost exclusively based upon our memberships. So we give folks 40 minutes or so today, I guess closer to 50 minutes of free content. And hope that if you have the financial means, you will become a member at majority.fm. It is literally, I think, like 33 cents a day, business days. I'm not even spreading it out over 7 days. And, of course, one of the benefits you get as being a member is not just that know that you're supporting the show, but we give you an extra 50 minutes of content a day. And if you want one of the one of my legacy comedy DVDs, that is also available to you. Our app is coming. Apparently, the iTunes developer or the Apple developer site was hacked, and so it that has slowed down our progress in terms of beta testing. But for those members who have asked to be beta testers, we will let you know via email. You can also support this show by going to the homepage at majority.fm, scrolling down, finding the Amazon link, clicking it, bookmarking it, buying your Amazon junk through there. We get a kickback. You will notice no difference. There's also next to that Amazon link a donate thing if you want to do a one-off donation, also very much appreciated. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. See you in the better half there. We're going to talk about the feds are now suing. The Department of Justice is now suing the state of Texas under another provision of the Voting Rights Act. We will talk about this in the better half. Also, the President Obama's speech and more. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment.
Say it and I will pay.